This is the Ghost Podcast, and today I have a guest, Mike Thomas. Mike, I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself to our guests and tell us a little bit about yourself and about your background.
Thank you very much for having me. So my name is Mike Thomas, and I call myself the Everyday Consciousness Coach. And I do trauma-informed mindful movement to help people reduce stress in their nervous systems, to help resolve trauma, to improve the quality of their lives by improving cognition, awareness, and a number of other things. So it's about making those complex neurophysiological processes easily accessible, which is why I call it being the Everyday Consciousness Coach. It's consciousness that we're improving in the process, but with very simple, small steps that are manageable, sustainable.
How did you get into doing this?
That's a great question. So I had some pretty severe early childhood trauma from in utero, as well as when I was an infant, which I found out about later. I just thought I have ADHD, you know, I'm spaced out and I'm hyperactive and a little bit odd. And as it turns out, all of those personality traits were trauma symptoms, but I did not know that until the last 10 years of my education. So what I ended up discovering as I started in personal training, and it evolved because anyone who has had a personal trainer or has been one often will experience the trainer becomes the therapist of the client. And so I ended up continuing to evolve and learn about integrative psychology in a number of different modalities, mind-body connection, meditation, Tai Chi, yoga. And what I found is that as I was able to help my clients more and more through getting to the bottom of what stopped them from getting what they want in terms of fitness, in terms of well-being, emotional balance, I started to discover this process of what's going on in the nervous system that's underneath behavior. And I started to realize, wow, some of my behaviors are not innate personality traits. They're actually adaptations to survive an environment early on in development. And now I think that's who I am, but it's actually just a way of coping with an early environment that I never updated, that I never corrected to grow along with my adult mind. And so as I went through this healing process, I discovered a number of things, including my cognition improved because a traumatized brain doesn't think effectively. It goes into an emotional state and scans the environment to survive. And so what I found through the healing process is my IQ jumped up significantly. And so all of these preconceived ideas about how I am and who I am in the world, they drastically changed because I realized all the things that I wanted to do that I thought were out of reach are completely not out of reach. It's just a matter of calming the stress response in my nervous system, which, by the way, is very difficult to assess in our culture. It's hidden in plain sight. And take small steps to improve our ability to learn. And as I did this for myself, I kept educating myself and helping my clients to do the same thing. And it just continued to evolve into what it is today. I now help support people in enriching their relationships through nervous system regulation. I help them with emotional balance in their own lives to help them reach their goals and connect to their spiritual sense of values, you know, what's important to them in life, and improve their mind-body connection. And I know that's a very vague term, but I'll leave it there for now.
That's a really incredible story. So you did this by yourself, or did you work with someone, or was it a combination of self-discovery and working with someone, or how did that happen?
It was quite a combination of self-discovery and support along the way. If any of you, the listeners, are familiar with the ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences, that study drastically changed our understanding of early adversity and how it affects development and how it changes our ability to be resilient. But specifically, if you look at Nadine Burke Harris, the Attorney General in California, she talks about how it's the number one health concern. If you don't address ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, you're not going to be able to address effectively addiction issues, obesity, suicidal ideation, heart disease, cancer, the list goes on and on of the mind-body experiences that don't function well if we have high stress load from experiencing survival states when we're supposed to be developing. We're supposed to experience safety early on. So it's not just about when we're in childhood, making sure that those bad things don't happen that we think about. You know, we don't want to be abused and we don't want to be neglected, you know, in order to develop properly. But there's also what we need that we don't necessarily get. This relational nourishing that happens through the exchange of body language with our caregivers creates this amazing experience of developing the brain and social and emotional intelligence. And this dovetails into a conversation about ghosting, because depending on how you were raised by your caregivers and the environment that either nurtured your brain in a positive way, or you were missing some nurturing, or you experienced abuse, you had things happen that weren't supposed to happen for healthy development. All of those things have predictable consequences on the personality and behavior. And so when someone ghosts, it's easy to look at that as something you should demonize them for. Like, that's not a good thing. You shouldn't do it. We just need to try and stop that from happening, right? And our survival response when that happens to us, because that's so painful when we experience abandonment, of course, we're going to go into a space of blame. That's a natural result of being in a survival state. Our brain stops working in a clear way, whether we're being abused or the abuser. And I'm using those terms very loosely. Emotional abuse, you might put the ghosting in that category.
One of the things I was wondering when you were speaking just now is, how does someone develop the self-awareness that they need to do this type of work?
That's a great question. And I think there are as many avenues as there are human beings and possibilities. There are just so many different ways you can look into how your life is going and how you want it to go better. Maybe you discover it through yoga and notice, oh, I'm a little bit more calm and I'm able to focus on the things that I want in my life a little bit easier after, let's say, a couple months of practice. Or maybe your life is just really stressful. You're just going and going and going, and you can't seem to have a moment to stop and have a bit of peace in your mind and your body, and you just can't seem to slow things down. There are so many things in our everyday lives that indicate that our nervous system has too high of a stress load, and it's so common in our culture that it's hidden in plain sight. So just think about the values that tend to be put out there in the media, for example. I need to achieve the greatest possible things and get famous and have people admire me and gain all of these material things and accomplish all of these accolades that people can finally see my value for. It's very externally based, right? And it diminishes the value of human connection, which is essential for us to develop ourselves as human beings. And so because of that, our culture is, I would say, functionally blind to where this is happening. I believe it's happening everywhere. If you look at Dr. Gabor Mate's work, he has this amazing movie called The Wisdom of Trauma. I highly recommend it, where he outlines a lot of these concepts and shows where it plays out in society. The long and the short of what I'm getting to here is that we all are traumatized in a dysfunctional society that values what we do and sets up life in a way where it's very difficult to nurture our children, to nurture and resource ourselves. So of course it's going to be difficult to nurture our children properly, and so on. And so because this support system that we need to develop properly is lacking, the solution and the symptoms of the problem, we're talking about a fundamental change in how we look at life in our culture. And that's going to take a grassroots movement where people see, I want my life to be better. How can I do that? And so, you know, for example, in a podcast like this, where we're discussing the nervous system traits, I'll mention a number of things that I'm going to guess most, if not all of the listeners are going to connect with and go, oh, yeah, my stress load is high. what would happen if I lowered my stress load with some simple tools? How much better could my life get?
Can you give an example of how this actually works in a real life situation?
Sure. So I'll use my example because I know all so many nuances of it. It's easier to flesh out. So the abuse that I experienced early on, I mean, there was abuse later on when I was conscious and more developed that I remember. But in utero, my father beat my mother. And also when I was an infant, and she shielded me with one hand and held me with the other. That experience essentially created a survival environment that became my lens through which I look at life. I didn't know that I was looking at my life through that lens, but what resulted later on throughout my life is that I would dissociate. That is, I would space out in a number of circumstances. So in school, I would constantly be looking out the window. Someone would ask me a question and I wouldn't hear them. I was lost in my own world. This is a functional survival adaptation. What I mean by that is because I was in such pain and such fear and hypervigilance throughout my life, and I didn't know that was the case. That was normal to me. My body shut down awareness, so I didn't have to feel that pain all the time. So that spacing out, that lack of being present, was a way of keeping me from feeling the pain that I would have felt if I was fully aware of the pain going on emotionally, even physically. It ended up manifesting as a number of physical issues. I had epilepsy when I was younger for about 4 years. My appendix ruptured, and a number of other issues, a lack of coordination. And I loved sports, but I just couldn't get it. And little did I know, the experience of lacking coordination was because I was dissociated from my body. I wasn't able to connect to it directly. And so not only was I not able to be coordinated because of that for obvious reasons, but I wasn't able to learn, because when we're not in a low stress load and perceive safety in our nervous systems, what do we prioritize? We prioritize surviving. We don't prioritize creativity, empathy, looking at what we can possibly be in the world. And, you know, I had hopes and dreams like anyone else, but they always seemed out of reach. And I just didn't seem to be able to get myself together or discipline myself until I found a couple of different pathways. For example, Tai Chi drastically changed my life. It allowed me to be calm in a way that I couldn't access through meditation. As a side note, when you're traumatized, that's a shutdown state. And so if you try and sit still and close your eyes, your body may likely interpret that as a re-traumatization experience, as if you're not supposed to move, you're not allowed to move. It gives you that sense of being trapped, helpless, hopeless. And so sitting still and closing your eyes for meditation is not appropriate for a large majority of people until they change their nervous system mode, so they're not perceiving survival all the time. And when I say perceiving survival, it's symptoms like that are hidden in plain sight, like spacing out all the time, or feeling anxiety, or racing mind, or I just can't seem to focus, or I procrastinate. I could go on.
Let's go back to a few moments ago when you were talking about how this past trauma can lead someone to ghost other people. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. So I would say the easiest way to understand this is to give a basic run through of what we need to develop in a healthy way, and then show the different basic ways that we can not develop in a healthy way and how that shows up in behavior. So we'll start with what's called secure functioning behavior, where we receive emotional attunement from our caregivers, which creates safety. Emotional attunement looks like a baby cries and the mother tries to figure out what the baby needs. And that baby will keep crying until the mother figures out what exactly that specific cry is about. Is it a dirty diaper? Is it hunger? Is it pain? Is it needing comfort and being held? When the parent can attune to the child that way, or chooses to attune, even if they're not great at it, what it does is it creates a sense of safety in the child. And so their brain and their body is capable of developing in a healthy way. Now, for any of you out there who might be concerned, like, oh man, that sounds like a tall order. That sounds very difficult. No wonder we're all traumatized. Secure attachment functioning only requires 30% of the time to be on the mark. The rest is repairing ruptures. So whenever it doesn't go well, you just keep trying. And so it's actually not very much pressure at all when you value attunement, when you value being connected emotionally to the people around you. And of course, we all as parents want to connect emotionally to our children. Sometimes we're just not in a state where we're able to do it well. You know, maybe we're stressed or we're busy or, you know, we're trying to handle something to help them. Maybe we're making a meal for them. And, you know, our son or daughter comes, hey, mommy, I want something. Hold on. You know, and they may take that as an abandonment in a sense, not being able to be there for them in that moment. But like I said, it only takes about 30% of the time and the rest is repair. You go back later and go, okay, I wasn't able to hear you before, but I would really like to hear what you needed now that I have addressed what I needed to address. And so it creates a flexibility in the nervous system. And so what this results in a healthy individual in adulthood is emotional flexibility to meet our own needs and to meet the needs of the people that we're connected to. And a really important side note here is that our relationship patterns with our caregivers will show up with our intimate partners as adults. And this is why you get some of the talk about Freudian theories, that, you know, marry your mother or your father type of concept. It's on first glance, it seems kind of messed up. But what it really is similar patterns. You don't actually want to connect to your actual mother and father, but those behaviors that they exhibited with you early on, that's going to be familiar to you, but it'll be body language. So it's not something you'll know consciously. You'll just go, wow, I'm really attracted to this person. I feel so safe and comfortable in their presence. I just feel like I know them already. These are unconscious cues that we are experiencing familiar, what are called implicit memory patterns. It's the memory in our bodies that we remember from early in development. So what happens when that doesn't go well? And this goes into some of the behaviors in dating, including ghosting. So the first level of non-secure attachment is called anxious ambivalent attachment, also known as preoccupied. And that happens when there is inconsistent emotional attunement from the caregiver in infancy. And what that does is it creates this sense in the child that there's uncertainty as to whether they will get their needs met emotionally. And so their nervous system revs up. You might call the anxious style the one that runs hot. They're just constantly, I need you. Oh, you're going to leave me. It's this constant catastrophizing, this negative bias. Interestingly enough, it's the style of attachment that is closest to secure. So a lot of it, I'm tempted to say is in their heads, but that's not very compassionate or accurate. What it is their bodies are perceiving survival. And so their behaviors show up as what's called protest behavior, a way of bidding for affection, for attention. And often because there's an imbalance there and they don't know it, it's underneath the surface, they'll often push people away because they come on too strong. And this brings us to the next level of stress in the nervous system, the avoidant dismissive type. The avoidant dismissive type not only didn't experience consistent emotional attunement from their caregivers early on, but they experienced what's called neurological neglect. That is, let's say, unfortunately, this is very common. I would say we have a very avoidant society. If we're to look at the behaviors, particularly the values that I mentioned earlier on, focusing on externals, you know, how can I prove my worth? It's very externally based. And the reason for that is that there is a lack of development of the social and emotional circuits of the brain in that context. So imagine a baby that's crying in the crib. And I don't know if you remember the Ferber method, but the Ferber method was to let them cry it out. And eventually they would stop crying. And on the surface, we went, oh, that's great. They're calming themselves. They're soothing. We now know from looking at attachment as a regulation theory, so not just the behavior, but what's going on in the nervous system, that they're actually going into overwhelm and their bodies are shutting down. That's when the crying stops. They're not capable of regulating their own nervous systems. They need the soothing of the caregiver. So this is a drastic paradigm change. Knowing that this is the case, not only does it put tremendous pressure on mothers, but then that puts, if the relationship between the parents is healthy, it puts tremendous pressure on the father to support her because she's not going to be able to do that on her own for very long without getting very stressed. And the baby will perceive that body language and mirror that in what are called their mirror neurons. So the mothers need support, the fathers need support, the families need support, the communities, and so on outward in order to make sure that this ability to stay attuned with their children is possible. And we live in a society where as soon as mothers give birth, it's considered a virtue to go right out to work and make it happen. And there are some wonderful things about that because of the ability to support themselves and create financial stability. That needs to happen. So what's going to happen in the development of that child if this becomes the norm, which it seems to be right now? The result is they either have a nanny or maybe daycare, or you know, maybe it's the father staying home, or an aunt or a grandmother. Whatever it is, they're going to attach to this other person they see more regularly. And there's a rupture that goes on there between the mother and the baby because there's a natural attachment that's meant to happen there in terms of healthy development. And on surface glance, this can seem kind of archaic in terms of how it looks, you know, to the behavior. Like, what, we're supposed to keep all mothers home and keep them from working? I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that the way that we're designed to develop in a healthy way, we need to create a lot more support for mothers, a lot more support, so they don't feel that they have to go out and work right away. And if they do go to work right away, that they can, after work, not be so stressed that they can't come back and attune to their children with the time they do have. And so I could go on with that, but let's go to the last form of non-secure attachment, which is called disorganized. In other schools of thought, it's called anxious avoidant. And the reason why is because there's a combination of both anxiety and avoidance that happens because there is fear in the presence of the caregiver. Now, this could be an abusive caregiver, like I experienced early on in infancy and childhood, but it could also be that the caregiver that they're attaching to is experiencing fear. So if the mother is fearful, that's not necessarily because she's in a fearful environment. Maybe she was traumatized and her body language continues to convey what she has not healed in her nervous system. And this is essentially imprinted on the child. So, I have two grown children now, and I had no idea about this healing work back when I was raising them. And their mother and I both experienced some pretty severe early childhood trauma. So our children have mirrored our behaviors, our body language. And so they actually have the behaviors of children who are traumatized early on because they soaked in that blueprint of our body language. And so not only do we need to support mothers and fathers and families so that healthy development can happen, but we need to make sure that we're dealing with the past trauma that happened so that we can not continue this pattern through the generations. This is why if you look at attachment in terms of how it passes through the generations, because it's unconscious and through body language, if you don't know you need to do the work, it's going to show up in your children the same way it did for you. And so it just keeps getting passed down through the generations. A generation of people who went to war, that's going to create the avoidant response in all of their children, unless they do the healing work. And I'm pretty confident that most people in most wars that we know of have not done that healing work. And so you'll see an entire wave of children that develop poorly in specific ways. Take the example of the pandemic and the shutdown and the lack of body language and attunement and social engagement. This is severely going to affect this generation the masks that covered up facial expressions that are required to convey safety to our children, they didn't get that, at least not most of the time. And of course, they weren't exposed to very many people. So I'm going to wrap that up and bring it into adult behavior, because I know that was a lot. So the adult behavior of the person who is anxious is going to be that of romantically looking out at what's possible and jumping the gun, not really taking their time in meeting someone and going through the stages, because there's this urgency in their nervous system to connect with an attachment figure so that they can regulate their nervous systems. What happens in anxious attachment is that they don't have the ability to self-regulate in the same way that someone who's secure does. Instead, they do something called external regulation. That is, they need someone else in order to calm their nervous system. And we all need other people in order to calm our nervous systems, but they can't do it on their own like a secure person can. So I want to emphasize that it's really important that we do need one another, and we are a social species. We need one another to regulate. As a matter of fact, if you look at this study in Romania a number of years ago, there was this whole wave of children who weren't able to be picked up in this orphanage, and most of them died. And the reason why they died is because they didn't have the attunement to regulate their nervous systems. Their autonomic processes like heart rate, blood pressure, digestion, immune system function, lymph system, all of the different functions that would be supported in a calm nervous system couldn't happen. They all got overwhelmed, stayed in that stress state until essentially they burnt themselves out and they died. And we need one another as a core need. We need attachment. And when we don't get our attachment needs met with our caregivers, if we don't have secure functioning from our parents, we can't connect to the other main important need in our human experience, and that's authenticity, to be authentically who we are as individuals. Because if our parents didn't, through most of the time, no fault of their own, provide secure attachment functioning, we learn to adapt and change our behavior in order to meet that need for attachment, because it literally is a matter of life and death in terms of survival and our nervous systems functioning properly. Our minds work better. We can think ahead. We're more empathetic and all of those things that make us more human. And so not having the attachment need met is so significant that children change their behavior. And this is where we get the personality traits that show up, like I was starting to describe with the anxious type. And so the anxious type is going to be, they can be overwhelming for someone who does not have secure functioning behavior with our nervous system. So often what will happen is, because the anxious and the avoidant type are somewhat opposite in terms of where they fall on the spectrum of behavior, they'll often end up getting together, and the avoidant person gets very easily overwhelmed. Why? Because they were neglected emotionally. And so what ends up resulting is that they don't have the circuitry to manage intimacy, connection emotionally with other people. And so they develop these personas of being hyper-independent. And it gets problematic when they start to date, because just like any other human being, they need other people, just like we all do. But what ends up happening is they get overwhelmed. And it could be something that happened in their childhood that they have an implicit memory about. So, you know, somebody brushes their hair in a way that, you know, their father did when they were an infant, and their father was right there, but not attuning with them. And so implicitly in their bodies, they get this bad feeling. They get this sense of, oh man, I'm overwhelmed and I don't know why. And it's this implicit memory of what happened in childhood. So what can happen is that the avoidant type will get so overwhelmed so easily, even though they want and need other people to survive, they end up getting overwhelmed. And so they don't even have the capacity to communicate what they need. They don't even know what they need. Most people who are avoidant don't really connect to, I don't have needs. I just get through my day. I just keep going. Maybe they're really hyper intellectual. You see a lot of academics that are avoidant. So as a result, if they're dating someone and they get to that point, often what's going on is they're overwhelmed if they ghost somebody. And this is not to excuse the behavior. It's to understand what's going on. If you develop a relationship with someone who has avoidant attachment traits, they need support, and they need support they don't know they need. And this can be really difficult to manage. So this brings me to another point of upholding boundaries. We need to start recognizing subtle behaviors that will let us know when we're dating if we're getting into one of these situations before it happens, or at least early on, so it's not quite so painful. So if there's any specific direction you want me to go with this, I'm happy to, but that's where the gist of attachment affects the ghosting phenomenon, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had thought up a couple questions while you were speaking, and you can answer these in any order. So do you think that avoidance ghost more often? And if you are someone who was ghosted by somebody with an avoidant attachment style, what is your recourse? What should you do? And I guess my last question is there hope for avoidance? If they don't have the self-awareness to even know that they can't, they're not capable, as you said, what happens to them?
So that's a perfect order of questions. So yes, I would say the avoidant type is going to ghost most often because of their lack of emotional development, their lack of ability to attune socially and emotionally. So it's one of those things where we all ultimately need to learn to become more flexible, not by forcing ourselves to with our behavior, but by learning to calm our nervous systems so that we're regulated enough that when these things happen, when someone ghosts us, that we can pick ourselves back up and reach out if we choose to reach out to that person. Maybe they respond, maybe they don't. And if they do respond, there are certain strategies that you can engage in that are really helpful. If they don't, who do you have in your life that can help you resource? Who's a friend that you can talk to help externally regulate your nervous system? Because we don't want to shame those types. If you need someone else to regulate, that's just where you are. And you can develop the skills to regulate your nervous system by practicing in a social context. It's not something we can really develop alone. And this is the difficult part. So to answer your question about, is there any hope for avoidance? Absolutely. Yes. And I've worked with and spoken with a number of colleagues who have avoidant attachment patterns in their behavior. And it's this choice to engage in personal growth, no matter what the style is. If you want to avoid this happening from this perspective, this neurobiological perspective, you want to make sure the person is interested in personal growth. That's a great conversation to have when you first start dating someone, on the first date, as awkward as it might be. If you don't want to waste time, if you don't want to create potential pain later, you may want to bring this up and go, listen, this is an experience I have, and this is a little vulnerable for me, but I want to make sure that I don't have this happen again. I like you, and I'd like to continue to see you. This date's going well, and you might feel the same, you might not. I would love to hear feedback there. And are you interested in personal growth? Are you interested in developing yourself emotionally? If there's no interest, I would say that's a huge red flag. If there's some interest, there's hope. And the big thing I think to look for in terms of the hope for the avoidant to develop is that not only do they need to be open to growth, but we need to look at not their behaviors on the surface, but what's going on underneath with some compassion. So in so doing, what we offer is a sense of safety for this other person that they may never have felt before. Now, I offer some caution with this because there is a tendency, particularly in the anxious type, to want to save someone, have a fixer-upper. And if you notice yourself going there, please, please back away. It's just not a healthy thing and it will not end well. I can save him or I can save her. I see that he or she has potential and she's trying or he's trying the best that they can. And it's one of those things where you can choose to go there, but just know it's going to be a rough road and it's not likely it's going to go well because you're going to be doing all the work. They need to show that they're interested. And underneath that behavior is a sad, scared child that needs support, comfort, love. And they also need to be willing, as the adult in the situation, they're no longer children. They need to be willing to take responsibility for how they come across. And if that's not there, back away. Uphold that boundary. Don't date someone who is showing that. It's probably not going to, if you have a history of this and it's painful for you, it's just going to repeat the pattern.
This topic really brings up a question or a couple of questions that I've really spent a lot of time thinking about. And I know people who've come on this podcast have spent a lot of time thinking about people like what you're describing that are ghosting because of past trauma and avoidance. You know, there's really a struggle when it happens to you. You know, yes, I understand they have trauma. They have things in their past. They don't have that self-awareness or self-growth. But it also, on the other hand, feels like they still know that that's not the right thing to do and the right way to treat someone. And trying to be empathetic towards their situation, but also feeling very hurt by what happened.
Yeah.
What do you suggest in that situation?
So again, a lot of this comes down to a sense of agency for yourself, a sense of, instead of trying to control others' behavior, going to a space of, okay, what can I do in this situation that allows me to connect to my values, that allows me to uphold appropriate boundaries and connect with someone I know is going to engage in mutuality. And so if that person shows mutuality and you really want to make it work and they're showing interest, but they're getting overwhelmed easily, and they probably won't know that's what's happening, they'll just text you less or call you less. And what you can do in that situation is you can offer to do things that have less intensity emotionally so they can take baby steps. And again, I want to reinforce that don't do this without talking to them about it. You want to make sure that they're engaged and they're on board, because you're not going to help sway them to get engaged in personal growth if they're not already interested. It's just not likely. But I'll give you an example of, if you're in a relationship with someone who's avoidant, whether it's very new or you've been dating for many years or even married, there are these steps that you can take to take care of each other's nervous systems. And Stan Tatkin, a famous attachment researcher, talks about a number of these things. So one I'm going to mention is this concept of separations and reunions, literal separation with your body. So if your bodies are touching, you're holding hands, and then you let go, there's a way that you can do that that doesn't create in your body the infant part of you, that part of you's sense of abandonment, by looking at them, like acknowledging them as you move away, or maybe stroking their arm as you let go of their hand. Or if you're in bed together and you're waking up, stroke their cheek or give them a kiss or whatever it is that feels right for you. The way that you separate changes that person's perception on an unconscious level of your connection. So separating in a way that's gentle, that honors that, yeah, separating is painful. Even something as simple as leaving the room and leaving for the day. You just want to have some sort of mindful connection with that person as you separate. When you reunite, instead of coming in and going, oh, I had such a hard day, and you know, I just need to do a couple things before I connect, prioritize connecting with your partner the first thing coming in that door. And if you can both be on the same page with that kind of personal growth, you're going to train each other's nervous systems to feel safe. And so you're going to feel more connected. You're the avoidant person in the relationship. And we're on a spectrum here. Even if you're both secure, one person's going to be more avoidant or anxious. The more avoidant person is going to feel less overwhelmed when you have those types of habits relationally and touching and connecting and looking at one another. And the anxious person is going to have consistency that they didn't have before, because these habits are in place. Because habits are somewhat automatic, because we just keep repeating them, you don't have to think about it as much. So it's less overwhelming for the avoidant. And it's insurance, you might say, that the anxious person is going to get the love, the touch, the connection that they need on a regular basis. And so if a rupture happens, if you have a fight, there's a wonderful technique called parallel play that can be helpful for the more anxious person to reconnect to the avoidant person, who I will say from personal experience, when I'm in an avoidant state, when I'm overwhelmed, it's really hard to reach out. And there's this infant part of me I've learned to connect to that wants my partner to reach out to me. And I just can't seem to do it myself. I'm more describing earlier before I've done the healing work that I've done now, but it was pretty extreme for a while where I would even do very childish things. Like I would look over my shoulder, little pout. I didn't even know I was doing it, but then somebody described it one time and I was mortified. And so I decided to address that. And so this connection that you can do with someone who's more avoidant, when it's not going well, they're overwhelmed, you can do this thing called parallel play. And what I mean by that is less intensity emotionally and intimately, but you're doing it together. So a good example would be watching a show together. There's not a lot of emotional energy required of both people, but you're enjoying something at the same time and you're both facing the same way. And your nervous system is attuned in a more of a surface way, but it's something. And it helps that avoidant person to work into getting used to connecting. You could do an activity together, like maybe working out or walking in the morning. That's also parallel play. There's this experience of looking directly at each other that can, one way of describing it is heat up the nervous system. And for the anxious person, oh yeah, this is great. More and more and more. And they'll hold eye contact way longer than someone who's more avoidant, who might have to look away because they just can't handle the feelings. Not to mention their tendency to dissociate, they might start to feel things they didn't know were there and be wildly uncomfortable with that. So that's a whole other process that we would have to do a whole other podcast about. But the experience of finding the level of connection that each person is comfortable with and making habits out of that is really what you want to work toward. And I can't emphasize this enough. Communicating outwardly about what your intention is, what you want to do, rather than going, okay, I heard this podcast and I know this thing's going to help. I know he or she is not going to take this well, so I'm just going to do it and see if things improve. Sure, it might a little bit, but ultimately, if they're not on board, it's going to be a pretty problematic trying to get them to shift their behavior. They might wonder what you're doing.
So let's say you have been ghosted and it's not an option to engage with that person anymore. How do you validate your own feelings of hurt and betrayal and anger while still holding empathy for people who did this to you potentially because they really can't, they don't have the work behind understanding their own behavior?
That's a great question. So there's a part of us when we're hurt on that level that wants the other person to acknowledge what they've done. And unfortunately, that's not really healthy for either person if there's not mutuality there. If the other person doesn't reach back out and they don't want to, the best thing to do is to start to process your own experience, to validate your own feelings. And there's this exercise that Dr. Daniel Siegel talks about. Very simple. It's called name it to tame it. When you're experiencing uncomfortable emotions, you first notice what's going on in your body. So you might put a hand on your upper chest, feel the breath moving, one on your belly, and just get a sense of your body. What am I feeling in my body right now? And describe those sensations in detail. And then connect to the emotions that you're feeling to validate those emotions by either writing them down or saying them out loud. Whether another person is there or not, it will reduce the intensity of that experience over time. So every emotion we experience actually only takes about 90 seconds to process. But when was the last time you got angry and it was over in 90 seconds? It just doesn't happen, right? The reason it doesn't stop after 90 seconds is because we reignite the process by ruminating about what went wrong and how it shouldn't have happened. All of these things that are out of our control, we hyper-focus on it and it keeps that emotional process going and we can rev ourselves up into deep grief or anxiety or anger, to just name a few. And ultimately what we want to do, if we want to make that better, to validate our own emotional experience, is to practice affirming to ourselves. And if you can, talk to a friend, because it's just not even close how powerful the connection to another human being is versus doing it yourself. So what I described just now is more what you do if you don't have anybody to talk to. And it's not ideal, but it's better than not doing it, because it will calm the emotional experience you're having. And it will help you connect to that you're okay now. And when those emotions are running wild and they haven't been processed, like I described, naming it, containment, it can keep our stress load so high that it's really difficult to see that we deserve validation, that it's okay that we feel what we feel. We might go into this downward spiral of, well, maybe I deserved it, or get really angry at the other person and, you know, talk about how they're a narcissist. And, you know, they very may well be. However, that's out of our control now. And the only way to move forward is to first address the nervous system response, ideally with a friend or by ourselves, and then look at, okay, so what can I do to have this happen differently next time? And those are some of the things I described earlier about knowing what's going on in your own nervous system and other people's, as well as choosing to engage with people who are interested in personal growth. It's just not even close to the same thing when you engage with somebody who has no interest there. It's probably going to come to a head eventually. Even if they're a well-developed, secure person, if they're not interested in growth, problems will happen. We have them happen because that's the human experience. And to not have a growth mindset in some capacity, to not value that, I would say is probably the biggest red flag in a relationship.
Mike, this conversation is really fascinating to me. It puts a lot of things in perspective for me personally and for our listeners as well, I'm sure. So thank you so much for joining me. Where can our listeners find you?
Thank you so much for having me on, first of all. This has been a pleasure. I love sharing these tools and helping people to connect to better lives through regulating their nervous system in any way, shape, or form. So if you want to see any more of my work and reach me, you can directly reach out by email, holisticfitnesslifestyle@gmail.com. That's with an H, H-O-L-S-T-I-C, fitnesslifestyle@gmail.com. And I have a course online on a platform called relationflix.com. So it's like Netflix, F-L-I-X, at the end of relation. So relationflix.com. And my course is called Relational Regulation. It's regulating your nervous system to enhance your relationship skills and tools to make your relationship experience better. I also have a Facebook group where we address regulating your nervous system more effectively to improve fitness on all levels, physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually, and in relationships. And that's called the HFL, stands for Holistic Fitness Lifestyle, HFL 30-Day Fitness Habit Reboot. And then the title describes a program that you can choose to engage in, but it's a supportive community that's free. And you're welcome to join me there, or even just follow me at Thrive Now by Holistic Fitness Lifestyle on Facebook.
Fantastic. And I will put all of that information in our show notes as well. And listeners, if you have a ghost to share, you can find us on Instagram at The Ghost Podcast Stories. You can also find us online at theghostpodcast.com. And you can also send an email to theghostpodcaststories@gmail.com. And as always, thank you for listening.